Young, searching, fresh out of business school, Phil Knight borrowed $50 from his dad and launched a company with one simple mission: import high-quality, low-cost running shoes from Japan. Selling the shoes from the trunk of his Plymouth Valiant, Knight grossed $8,000 that first year, 1963. Today, Nike's annual sales top $30 billion. In this age of startups, Knight's Nike is the gold standard, and its swoosh is more than a logo, a symbol of grace and greatness. It's one of the few icons instantly recognized in every corner of the world. One of the world's most influential business executives, Phil Knight, is the founder of Nike Incorporated. He served as CEO of the company from 1964 to 2004 and as board chairman through 2016. He's telling his story in the new memoir, Shoe Dog, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Phil Knight to the roundtable. Phil, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on the show. It's great to be here.
At what point did you know that you wanted to tell this story to the public at large?
Well, I got asked to do by several different publishing houses over, you know, three or four decades, and I never had much inclination to do it. But when I got to be about 75 years old, I said, well, I better do this or it's not going to be done. So I guess age was the motivating factor.
When you look at the story, and maybe it's difficult for you to think about it this way, but what do you find fascinating about your own story?
Well, the thing that I always kind of come back to is the wonderful group of sort of eccentric brothers that worked together with me and others to make the company that it became. It was a wild time, and it was a unique group of people. And one of the great pleasures of going back and writing the book was getting back together with a couple of them and reminiscing about some of the stories.
You write about this in the book, of assembling this crew to come together. What were you looking for in that crew? And at that point, did you even know solely what you wanted to do with that crew?
Well, I think even when we were at our smallest level, that we were very ambitious. We thought we knew what was a better running shoe, and that we could develop a better running shoe, and that people would buy it. And that was kind of where it started. But basically, there's no such thing as a shoe school in the United States. So we had to look other places for people, and we looked at lawyers and accountants that weren't really very happy in what they were doing. And they brought together a unique group of people.
And again, you write about this, but as far as that group of people, you all had separate skills. You all had things that you did very well. And I'm curious as to how much of it was luck and how much of it was really picking the right people at that time.
Well, I think there's a little of both. I mean, obviously that we were looking for sort of a certain type that, one, we were looking for guys that were bright, and we were looking for people that, were intense and wanted to succeed. And I guess to some extent were unhappy in what they were doing and kind of what I guess I would call the establishment life. So they were looking for other things, and that's what appealed to me. And obviously there was some luck involved in that because we found some really able people, but that's kind of who we were looking for too.
Originally it was Blue Ribbon. Tell us a little bit about Blue Ribbon and how that ultimately shaped you, because it was a company that you worked for quite a while before you were forced into Nike.
Yeah, when I went into the factory in Japan to see about them, see about me distributing shoes in the United States for them, they said, "What company do you represent?" And I had to come up with something, and so I came up with the name Blue Ribbon Sports, which we were kind of stuck with for a whole number of years. And we started out as the distributor, and we got pretty good at it, and we got it up from zero to $2 million in sales, and they then jerked the distribution. We were more responsible for success than they were, and so when we said we'd do it again, we're going to do it on our own brand name, and that's what we did.
And I guess this is really kind of the a real moment in the story, a terrifying moment in the story, where everything almost collapsed. Everything that you had built, everything that you had worked on with this group of people, almost goes away completely. What happened, and what were you forced? Why were you forced to reboot that put you into this new model?
Well, I don't know which time that we almost failed that you're talking about, because there were several near-death occasions. Going chronologically, the first near-death is when the Japanese manufacturer jerked the distribution agreement from us. And, you know, in retrospect, it was probably the best thing that ever happened to us. But we knew that with our new line, which we called Nike, if we didn't get through that first year with some degree of success, it was over. And nobody had ever heard of the line before, so it was a near-death experience, but there were several others to follow.
And why is that good for a company? Why is that good for a businessman such as yourself to have those near-death experiences?
Well, I don't know that I'd recommend it to entrepreneurs, but looking back, I think it it helped us become what we were, what we became. That it made us tougher. It made us appreciate what we were achieving, and it was a time where you know, every day you came to work, you knew what you did mattered. You didn't know if you're going to meet payroll on Friday, and that creates a certain culture and a certain attitude, which I think was ultimately helpful to the company that we became.
When you look at things, things we take for granted now, but just the swoosh, how did that come to be?
Well, the whole thing, you know, that they said that how did Nike become successful? I'm reminded when John Kennedy was asked how he became a war hero, and he says, "Easy, they sank my boat." that's kind of our story as well. That we had to come up with a brand name and a logo overnight, and basically we went to an art student at Portland State University and hired her at $2 an hour to come up with designs, which one we finally picked. To be our logo, and the one we finally picked, and the one that she drew up was what we call a swoosh, or the kind of the winged symbol, and it's now become well known around the world.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it is considered one of the few icons that is instantly recognized in every corner of the world. At what point did you realize you had that? That you had something that was beyond what you could have dreamed?
Well, there were a lot of different moments, but for me personally, the one where it really hit home is 1989, when the Berlin Wall came down. And about 3 months later, that I went into what used to be known as East Berlin. And there were two, you know, kind of real old brick buildings, but they were sporting goods stores. And both of them had big banners up with the swoosh said, "Now available." And Nike shoes in East Berlin, that was something I never dreamed of.
And was there always a mantra? Was there always something that you wanted in that product, that you wanted anything that had that swoosh on it, that certain ingredients had to be there to make it work before you would move forward with it?
Yeah, that's everything. That we believe that we started out obviously a group of runners, and so a running shoe is for a distance runner is the one piece of equipment that really matters. And of course, the coach that was so influential, my partner and mentor Bill Bowerman, he just believed an ounce in a running shoe and for a mile was equal to 10,000 pounds in the last 5 yards. I don't know if his arithmetic is right, but the basic idea was right. So that was really where we came from, that running shoes can make a difference. And then as we broadened out, we said other shoes obviously can make a difference in other sports. So our whole thing is innovation and making things better that really work. And then we got into apparel, found out that, yes, you can make a difference in garments that that people wear. Our football uniforms now are lighter, and all those things matter, and that's what we try to put into every product.
In the years that you ran the company, and when you were looking at this incredible growth, and yes, you mentioned that there were certainly times where things weren't going well, but For much of this story, you're on top of the world, right?
Well, yeah, I suppose that after 1974, 1975, that after several years of, almost 10 years of struggle, that the waffle trainer hit. And from that time on, sales were not a problem.
And how much leeway, how much freedom does that give you when you have success and you know that you've got a product that works, you know you have an audience, and you can be really creative?
Yeah, no, it changes your whole attitude. You know it's working, you know it's going to work. And the culture of the company changes, and you can feel it when you walk in the office and everybody is kind of much more upbeat.
You talk about not really, I think there's a line in the book of you saying that there weren't many victory parties, that you didn't take a lot of time out to kind of celebrate those moments. You just kind of moved on to the next thing.
Yeah, well, in our business, our industry, really, every 6 months is a new life because our product line changes. The consumer is concerned in what's new, and our product line changes, 50% every 6 months. So you can hit two or three seasons in a row, which two or three times we did hit two or three seasons in a row, and then all of a sudden come a clunker. And so you don't have a lot of time to rest because even though this 6 months product line was very well received, there's no guarantee the next one will be. So yeah, we ran an ad. It was one of our internal favorites. It didn't resonate with the outside world too much, but we said there is no finish line. That basically you get done with this race and immediately got to run another one.
You served as the CEO of the company to 2004. How hard was it for you to, obviously still chairman of the board, but how hard was it for you to give up the day-to-day?
Oh, it really wasn't hard. It was I was 68 years old, and I was running out of energy. It was the best job in the world, but the CEO needs to really work hard, long hours, and I was fading on being able to do that. And Mark Parker, we had a guy that I'd worked with for 25 years. I knew him quite well, and I had great confidence in him. So it really wasn't hard. I know I've read other biographies of businessmen, and it's really hard to give up. Bill Paley being the obvious, right? But it wasn't hard for me, and it's worked quite well.
When you think of your impact still on the company, what do you feel that impact is? Because obviously, more than anybody else, you have the historical memory, and you know you've been there since the very beginning.
Yeah, well, no, I think that basically the culture that was created from the early days, and I just think kind of the mantras that run true today, listen to the voice of the athlete, that still resonates around the company today and is still working.
How important was advertising for you and for the company?
It was funny because, as I tell in the book, I was no advertising fan. When we got hooked up with Wieden and Kennedy, particularly Dan Wieden, well, he was really kind of a creative genius, and it was hugely important to our success that... The book basically ends as we go public in 1980, and the real advertising victories came after that. But it is touched on in the book, and that the Wieden has walked into the office and we begin doing things together, and his genius and some of the great athletes we had and some of the products with it, it really has been hugely important to our success. Then I've often said, if you get a great shoe or a great product, shoe or clothes, and you get a great athlete to endorse it, and you get a great ad to go with it, it's 1 + 1 = 10. It really kind of creates a magic. And it's not easy because we've missed on a lot of that. But when you get it right, it's really it's a big deal.
And you can't miss, obviously, I would assume the biggest success being Michael Jordan, correct?
Michael Jordan was really kind of took us to another level. And with all those things, great advertising, great product, great athlete.
And continues to be great for you. If you have...
Astonishingly, yeah.
Yeah.
He sells, I think, six times as much product today as he did when he was an active player.
I'm wearing a pair right now.
Oh, good! You look great.
Thank you. When you think about that though, and obviously this is the story that so often we hear, when you have an athlete and then the athlete does something stupid or even criminal, well then that hurts you too, doesn't it?
No question. It's obviously I think the ultimate example is Lance Armstrong. It was he was selling a lot of product. He was a hugely popular icon, and then it was done while he was on steroids, and it all came crashing down. So you run a big risk. That's right. And we look into our guys and girls into the heroes, the Serena Williams and Allyson Felix. Are great role models, but we look into their backgrounds before we sign them. But that doesn't mean you're going to bat 1,000. You're going to miss on some. Mm.
And is it short-term or long-term? I mean, obviously it hurts their career. And once you pull your endorsement, you're able, because of the other athletes, to move on? Or does it still take quite a while to get over all that?
Well, yeah, we're competing in a whole number of sports, but whatever particular sport that athlete is in, that it will hurt you in that sport for probably 1 or 2 years. You'll be able to compensate a little bit because you're in a lot of other sports, but when it comes a cropper, it hurts you.
When you think of the partnerships that you've been able to do with the sports themselves, that's become a big part of the success as well, right? I mean, the fact that everyone who is because of the deals that you can make, that everyone who is part of a particular sport or a particular team is going to wear your product, that's key, isn't it?
Sure. What the heroes are wearing is important. That each sport is a little bit different. In the NBA, obviously, each athlete can wear whatever shoe product he wants. He has to wear the team uniform that the league selects. In college basketball, each team makes its own deal. So each sport and and whether it's a pro or whether it's college, they're all a little bit different. But whatever the heroes are wearing is important.
The amazing thing about your company is that you've been able to stay so ahead of the curve for so long, and to see new trends and to move ahead. Is obviously that's not an accident. So how do you continue to do that, and how do you look at it as, especially with something as fickle as fashion?
Well, first of all, we got beat up pretty good by Reebok in the late 1980s, and it hit home that people care what their shoes and clothes look like. We were really focused on the function. Does the shoe help you run longer distance more comfortably, type of thing? And we didn't really concentrate too much on what it looked like. In some cases, sometimes the uglier the better. And we got beat up in the 1980s, and we learned that lesson. So what the product looked like is important. And for us, the fashion runway is not Paris or London or New York. The fashion runway for us is the Super Bowl or the NCAA championship. That's our fashion runway. So we want great products that look good. And when they perform there, they can carry over to the rest of the world. And that's basically the way we look at things. And making products that make athletes perform better, that's why we're in business. And we preach that every single day. All of the 62,000 people hear that over and over. And so far, they've been listening.
As you mentioned, this story really brings us into the 1980s. So I assume you're working on the rest of it.
Well, I don't know. As I said, I've been told, and I find that really true, that, writing a book is a little like a woman giving birth to a baby. I don't know about that, but it's supposed to be a very painful experience, and that no woman has a second baby without going for a while and forgetting how painful it was. So I still remember how painful it was. So I don't know. Maybe a few months from now I'll get to work.
Was it just sitting down and writing it that was painful for you, or was reliving some of this painful for you?
No. Reliving was enjoyable, and sitting down. The original. It took 3 years, and the first 2.5 years were really kind of fun. That sitting down and writing it, and then getting together with Bob Odell and Jeff Johnson, two of the originals, got together with them a few times. And that was very enjoyable. But the last 6 months is just a grind. All of a sudden, you've got to deal with a publisher, and the publisher, Scribner, has been great. But a funny attitude that they're going to pay for the book, and then they want it delivered. And that all of a sudden, you're in the last 6 months that you got to get it done. And then it's just a grind. And then, of course, there's the promotion that had... I think the first 2 weeks after it went published, I had 18 different interviews in about 6 different cities. So that's a grind, too. So those two things are kind of grinds. But overall, it's been a pleasant experience overall.
When you look at the product, when you look at the career, what are you proudest of?
Oh, the company. The company is what I did with my life.
And at any point, you look at it and still say, all right, that looks pretty good.
I certainly do today. I recognize business is very competitive, but every day is a new competition. But I'm quite proud of what the company is doing.
The name of the book is Shoe Dog. It is published by Scribner. Phil Knight, a great pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on the show. I enjoyed it.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Shoe Dog. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.